Welcome to another episode of Capital Connection. As always, I'm your host, Matt Calder, and we're glad to have you here on the show. Today, we are going to be talking with Brian Balfour, that is, of course, the Executive Vice President of the Civitas Institute. We'll be talking with him about his most recent pair of articles coming out about poverty and the cause of poverty, and really delving down into some of the different things that we see of what kind of these different welfare type programs that have been going on, how effective they are, what other programs may be effective. You'll definitely want to tune into that for a little more information about the causes of welfare and sort of the effectiveness of different strategies to combat welfare. But first, of course, I want to talk about subscribing to the show, because if you're listening on the airwaves or you're listening on the website, you're not getting the show in the easiest possible way you can. And to do that, you can subscribe, and you can just search Capital Connection wherever you listen to podcasts, be it Apple Podcasts, something on the Android system, wherever you listen to podcasts, just search Capital Connection and you can subscribe to the show. Or you can continue listening on the website if you are. You'll find the show there as well. And also you'll find all of the archives for the entire show going back a couple of years now, as opposed to just finding the last couple of weeks, which is in the podcasting app online. But if you're still out there listening on the radio as well, we're glad to have you listening in whichever way you are. Also, we have social media for the show. We are on Facebook, we are on Twitter, we are on Instagram. Just search NCCAPCONN, that's NC CapCon or Capital Connection. You'll find us there. You can like our Facebook page, follow us on Twitter, follow us on Instagram, and keep up with what we're doing on there as well. And of course, I want to say before we get anywhere further along, this show is sponsored by the Civitas Institute, that is North Carolina's conservative voice. And you can find everything they have going on nccivitas.org. Without any further ado, we'll get to our segment with Brian Balfour. Brian, thanks for joining us back on the show. We're glad to have you on to talk about your two parts to your Toxic Agenda article on poverty in the state.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So the you split it up into two parts to kind of talk first about the policies of the left, which is really what Toxic Agenda ultimately is kind of built around, is highlighting these policies on the left that are damaging or destructive or dangerous for North Carolinians. And then part two is looking at alternatives for how to reduce poverty and how to you know, let people, you know, help people up out of poverty. So I guess kind of to start, let's, you know, go in the same order you did and talk about those policies on the left that are damaging, those welfare policies, those, you know, what the goal of the policy is versus what's kind of actually happening, and kind of take that away there on that.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, so as you mentioned, the first part of this two-part series, evaluating poverty in North Carolina and the approaches that the left has taken. The first part, really, we look at the left's preferred approach, and I certainly try to make the case and make the argument that the left has been taking the wrong approach to poverty. And what it seems like they're trying to do is not necessarily to reduce poverty, and by reducing poverty, you know, we mean lifting the economy, growing the economy, creating more jobs so that fewer people live in poverty. What they seem to be intending to do is try to just mitigate the negative effects of being poor. And in so doing, they actually make the problem worse. So, you know, I make the case that, you know, really the only meaningful way to reduce poverty is to increase productivity. That means, you know, you're generating more goods and services that people value, people need. There's a greater abundance of those things, and therefore, you know, the poorest among us have access to more and more of those things to satisfy their needs. That's how you overcome poverty in a society. But instead, the left has been just really creating all these programs to just hand out, you know, benefits and cash in some cases to people who are poor, and really it creates perverse incentives. Oftentimes we call it a poverty trap, where people will be confronted with a situation where if they're in a low income or no income household, and they're receiving potentially thousands, maybe even tens of thousands worth of benefits between Medicaid and food stamps and countless other government programs. If they, you know, these are means tested, so if they start to either get a job or take on more hours or have an opportunity for a better job at better pay, they risk losing thousands and thousands of dollars worth of benefits. So financially, sometimes if they, you know, it's really kind of gets it backwards. If they take a job to improve themselves, they actually end up, because by way of losing some of these benefits, they make themselves financially worse off. So it ends up, you know, people kind of rationally confront this choice and say, well, why am I going to take this job opportunity or take on more hours and everything if it's going to make me worse off financially? And so people kind of get stuck in this poverty trap. And then, of course, the longer this goes on, the longer people are out of the workforce or maybe staying, you know, avoiding climbing the ladder, if you will, because of the threat of losing these benefits, then the less employable they become in the long term. It's just kind of this negative, vicious cycle that feeds on itself. So, you know, that's really kind of the case we lay out. And there's a couple of interesting statistical points here. I go back and I look at I draw on the numbers in North Carolina for about the last 25 years, basically, of North Carolina and the spending on these welfare programs in North Carolina, including, you know, cash assistance programs, Medicaid, energy assistance, and housing assistance, and so forth. And so I looked at the numbers, and in the last 25 years, basically, even breaking it down per capita and adjusting for inflation, the numbers have more than doubled in the 25 years. So obviously, there's more and more and more of our tax dollars being invested or spent into these welfare programs to try to reduce poverty. So what is the result? Well, you look at the poverty rates in North Carolina over that same time span, and of course there's fluctuations, you know, along with the cyclical economy. Typically ranges between about 12 and 17%, but overall the trend line has actually been upward for poverty rates in North Carolina over that time. So, you know, we're looking at all this money, and I even came up with an estimate for the total amount of money spent during that time, that 25-year period on these public welfare programs, and it topped $570 billion. So basically, we're looking at, just in the state of North Carolina here, spending more than $500 billion over this 25-year period to fight poverty. And what have those results been? Nothing. They have nothing to show for it. If anything, poverty has been trending upward during that time frame.
Right. I mean, I'm looking at that graph that you've got here, and that's definitely what I'm seeing there. And it's just, it, you know, what comes to mind, I guess the first cliche that comes to mind is, you know, if you give a man a fish, you feed him for a day. If you teach a man to fish, you feed him for the rest of his life. And it's sort of applicable here in that, If you're giving this, you know, this Band-Aid, it's just kind of, you know, I think in your article you said it, mitigating the symptoms of poverty. You're putting food in their bellies, a roof over their head, but you're not working them towards doing that for themselves. And then if they do work towards that while they're getting there, they lose something that's worth more to them, and that it just, you know, you call it a poverty trap, and it really is. I mean, because I know that when you get one benefit, it's much easier to get the next benefit and the next benefit and the next benefit, and it really becomes easier, and it seems like that's just, you know, more of that, you know, keeping you and pulling you even further into that trap, because you know, you get Medicaid, and then you get this other thing they put you on, and they put you on this other thing, and it's suddenly all this laundry list of benefits that you're going to lose if you go out and get the job at McDonald's.
Right. Yeah. And more to the point, in addition to that point you're making, those hundreds of millions of dollars that are being poured into this welfare system, those are dollars being taken from taxpayers, right? Taxpayers across North Carolina. Those are dollars that could have otherwise been spent investing in productivity, which, as I mentioned at the beginning of the discussion, you know, productivity is the only really way to meaningfully reduce poverty by the increasing the abundance of goods and services available to everybody. And so, you know, not only are we trapping these folks in poverty, we're taking away the tools necessary to actually lift the state's economy and in turn lift people out of more people out of poverty. And then there's one more thing that I found really fascinating looking at the data and talking about poverty, and I think is something that is completely you know, any discussion about poverty in North Carolina or America in general or anywhere is really lacking if it does not address this fact. And that is, I was looking at the numbers about fatherless homes in North Carolina and how that relates to poverty. And what I found was really fascinating. This is from 2016 American Community Survey data from the Census Bureau. And I found that North Carolina families with at least one child in the home, headed by a married couple, they have a poverty rate of under 9%, so 8.7% there. But in households with at least one child in the home, headed by a female householder only with no husband present, that poverty rate skyrockets to 42.7%. So we're looking at roughly, a household is roughly five times as likely to be in poverty when there is no father in the home. And that is just astounding. And I think it's absolutely irresponsible for any discussion about poverty to leave that fact out.
So, and then the first thing that comes to mind, like devil's advocate, is what about a home where there's just a father? So a single father home. Are there statistics out there for that?
Yeah, curiously, there was not. I don't know why they didn't track that. Maybe just statistically that it's not that numerous, so it's not something they track. But yeah, just very specifically, it was looking at those households without a husband present.
Okay, so that really is the
yeah, absolutely. You know, I would suspect there's a strong correlation there, whether it's a female or a male head of household, but a single parent household, that there's a strong correlation there for poverty. But just you know, just the way society is, it's typically the single mother in the home, just numerically, you know, compared to the single father in the home. And I think that's probably a large reason why the Census Bureau tracks that specifically. Again, just astounding. Five times as likely to be in poverty when there's no father in the home. That was basically the strongest correlation I could find, even more so than education levels or anything else. It was just that single, you know, fatherless home.
Right. And I mean, that is definitely not the popular thing to talk about, it for sure. I mean, it's definitely significant, and yet it's pretty well ignored in all these discussions. They'll kind of like not want to talk about this. And it's like, this is a huge, huge, you know, statistically significant factor that does not get play because it is uncomfortable to talk about. You know, we're not supposed to talk about that. You know, it's just the way it comes out to me is, you know, the single mom can do anything that two parents can do. You know, the I'm the dad too stuff. Father's Day is coming up now. You'll have the single moms that celebrate Father's Day as well as Mother's Day, and vice versa. You'll have the single fathers who celebrate Mother's Day and Father's Day. And that's a whole other discussion. But moving past that, you're not supposed to talk about the inefficiencies and the difficulties in what in the statistics is coming out and bearing out. Definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I don't think there's any way to, you know, there's no simple necessarily solution to this. You know, the trend lines are very distinct when you look at tracing back single parent households, especially single mother households, and correlate that to the advent of really the biggest expansion of the welfare state, which was the Great Society under LBJ. And one thing I point out, I looked at some of the data nationwide going back to the mid-60s when the Great Society was really implemented and ratcheted up. The rate of unmarried births since that time has tripled. So, I mean, this is not, you know, single, you know, single motherhood is not something that's always been with us. This is something that a lot of people argue, and I think it's a very, they can make a very strong case that this has been heavily, this trend has been heavily influenced by the government coming in with their welfare state programs and trying to replace the father with a government check. And that's just kind of the cold hard reality, that the facts really point to that. It's very I think it's a very strong argument to make. And again, I think any discussion about poverty, that needs to be included.
Right. And I don't want to get into the subsidizing and taxing discussion we've had on the show before. You know, if you don't want something, you tax it. If you want something, you subsidize it. You said it in this article. We've talked about it in relation to the you know, tobacco prices in New York City and the giant sodas. And then, you know, here in North Carolina, the government wants you to, you know, will pay you to grow certain crops. They'll subsidize you growing these crops to get you to pay them or to get you to grow them. So they've got this supply. So that's definitely, I don't think there's not really a way to argue that when you look at it on this, you know, this side, and then you get to the income side and corporate income tax and the state, you know, the personal income tax, and they go, well, this isn't going to reduce productivity. Well, yes, it is. And that was one of the things you talked about in the part two of the article, of ways, you know, conservative policies that would help with getting people out of this poverty trap. What are the other ones?
Right, absolutely. And you know, I wanted to add the part two to this series because it's, you know, it's easy to criticize, and try to point out what you feel is not working. But, you know, then you get confronted with the question, well, what should be done? And so that's where I wrote part two of the article. And certainly this is by no means meant to be an exhaustive, you know, list of policy prescriptions. But these are things that I think are actually achievable within the next, you know, legislative session or two. Certainly, one thing that you kind of touched on was we talk about eliminating the corporate income tax. That is set to fall to 2.5% next year. It was just a handful of years ago, 6.9%, one of the highest in the Southeast. They've done a really good job of dropping that. So I think it would be a great opportunity to just go ahead and just pull the plug on that corporate tax anyways. You know, a lot of academic research has shown that the state corporate income tax has the largest negative impact on economic growth of any of the major taxes. So, you know, I think a lot of the positive economic news we've had in North Carolina the last handful of years can be certainly in no small part attributed to the reduction in the corporate income tax. It's being whittled away to such a low rate. I mean, let's just go ahead and pull that Band-Aid all the way off. There won't be a huge impact to budget revenue. It'll make a really big indicator to businesses that North Carolina is welcoming and open arms to business investment, to just go ahead and eliminate that corporate income tax. So not only will it help economic growth and create jobs in North Carolina, also kind of as some icing on the cake, you know, from folks like us who are opponents of corporate welfare, you're kind of taking that off the table in terms of corporate welfare. A lot of the corporate welfare programs in North Carolina give targeted credits against the corporate income tax. So if the corporate income tax is gone, then it kind of takes away one of the tools that the corporate welfare crowd likes to use with their cronies. So and then other things I get into to help economic growth and in turn lift poverty is one of the things certainly is occupational licensing requirements. And there actually just recently was a study by the Mercatus Center at George Mason University that found that North Carolina licensed 188 occupations in North Carolina. 22% of the state's workforce is licensed. And basically what most of these licensing just end up being is just a barrier of entry for people to try to ply their trade, you know, to earn a living here in the state. And, you know, why do we want to make that harder? We want to reduce poverty. Why are we making it harder for people to work? Indeed, that study also mentioned some other research that found that for occupational licensure laws for 102 lower income occupations, found that North Carolina requires a license for 67 of them. So, I mean, we're putting these barriers, we're requiring, you know, a lot of time, perhaps training that costs money, and then, of course, just fees and annual renewal of the licenses and everything. You know, these are things that low-income people really don't have. You know, a lot of them don't necessarily have the extra time on their hands because they're trying, working hard to make ends meet already. You know, they obviously don't have the extra money or money for the fees or money for the additional training. A lot of these licensing training requirements are just absolutely absurd. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of hours of people having to pay for training just to do something as simple as cut hair, for example. Several examples of that. So, I mean, if we want people to climb out of poverty, why are we making it more difficult for them to work?
And most of these things are things that the market will take care of. If you're bad at cutting hair, you're not going to be cutting hair for long. And what is the downside of it? Well, maybe you have a bad haircut and you tell your friend and then, you know, the place shuts down. So a bad haircut is lost. And I mean, so many of these things are just things that the market would filter out, and people would not be in the business of doing it because they're not doing it well. This isn't a nuclear engineer who, if he messes up his job, we're in a really big problem. This is cutting hair. This is a locksmith. If I call for a locksmith to you know, I lock my keys in my Jeep, and he comes and he, you know, breaks my window getting me in, I'll go and I'll make, you know, I'll probably get my money back from him. But beyond that, I will go on and say, hey, this guy did this. This is not a very good locksmith. And his, you know, if he's done it to me, he'll do it to other people. They'll be doing reviews. And he'll go out. You know, he won't be able to do what he does because people will know, and the market will remove him. But this occupational licensure, it drives down the supply. So there's more demand, there's higher costs, and it protects incumbents, which is another problem when you have the you talk about the cronyism, given the people who are in the job. The power to decide who gets to do the job is a whole other issue. So, I mean, it's just giving power to people who don't need the power when you can put a system in place or let the system, the market, filter things out.
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, a competitive marketplace really is the biggest threat to bad actors. In terms of, you know, people who are in various professions, if they're not professional, if they're not safe, if they're not satisfying their customers, there's going to be someone else coming by, you know, coming along who is going to take that customer away from you, and so that is, I mean, that's a great regulator of the market. You know, we don't need government to step in. It's just that competition that really regulates the behavior of these actors. Making sure that they're doing a good job and being safe and providing quality service. And a lot of the research into this, you know, shows that greater amount of occupational licensure does not enhance consumer safety, does not enhance quality of the services being provided. It's just really a way, and most of these boards, licensure boards, are of course filled by incumbents, so they have an incentive to raise those barriers to entry to protect their, you know, protect their status, protect against competition. So therefore, their quality can suffer, or that, you know, their quality can suffer, but they're not going to be harmed because there's far fewer competitors to take the business away from them. Same thing with prices. You know, they can get away with charging higher prices because there's less competition. And in terms of safety, even, I was doing some reading about, I think, licensing of certain types of electricians, and where there's higher barriers to entry for electricians, what happens is there's fewer licensed electricians in the state, so there's fewer available. So people now are weighing whether to, for example, hire an electrician to do some work on their home or do some do-it-yourself route. More people tend to do the do-it-yourself route because there's so few electricians available. And so that actually ends up causing more problems from a safety perspective, you know, with people trying to figure out how to do it themselves because there's so few electricians actually available. So, you know, that it can actually backfire in terms of consumer safety if you increase those barriers to entry too high. And so that's, you know, again, one of the reasons why I put this article together is to not only point out how and why those welfare state policies are not working to reduce poverty, but also offer some other options for what the state can do. Immediately, these aren't like, you know, long-term down the road, you know, utopian plans or anything. I mean, these are just very tangible, very specific actions that the legislature can take that are certainly far from radical, that will certainly improve the economic condition of our state and in turn lift more people out of poverty.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on the show. Unfortunately, we had to cut this segment. I think that always happens when we get to talking about this stuff, but thank you for coming on.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you for joining us on the show today. We are glad to have you. We're glad to hopefully, you know, connect you to your capital a little more today. Of course, this being Capital Connection, we want to do that for you and connect you to what you have going on in your legislature, in your state capital, in the governor's mansion, in your state government in general. And again, thank you for joining us on Capital Connection.